darkly splendid abodes. The official podcast of Toronto the Libre. Exploring, if you will, practical philosophy. From science and the workings of the mind to spirituality, esotericism, and magic. Stooping down, dipping my wings, I came into the darkly splendid abodes. Often Crowley speaks of his different magical mottos as though he's referring to different individual people. From Frater Perdurabo to VVVVV, even distinguishing his mundane self as the man Crowley. Edward Mason and I will discuss this adept self and how it relates to the Thelemic system and to occultism in general. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love under will.
Good to see you as always. I guess today we are... Oh, I was going to start talking about how we're at the beginning of the winter here, but I don't know how helpful it is to date these things by talking about what's going on currently. I don't want to make it sound like dated and that sort of thing. Maybe winters won't even exist by the time this ends up.
Well, where I am, of course, I mean, it's about 21 degrees here in central Mexico in the mountains, so...
It practically doesn't. Winter.
Now, come here in August when we're getting drenched with tropical rains, it's a different story. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the topic I wanted to hold forth on today was the idea of the adept self. Basically, every different esoteric tradition, and in this I'm including Jungian psychology as a kind of quasi-esoteric tradition, has its own set of terminology about the different levels of our own being. You know, there's an essential self, there's a higher consciousness or a deeper consciousness, there's the various mental and emotional levels, and of course there's the outer personality. And in Thelema, we add this extremely elusive holy guardian angel, which is outside of everything and at the same time interpenetrates all of it. Now, I mentioned Jungian psychology because there's a good analog here to the Kabbalistic system in Jung's idea of the first and second personalities. He talks about this idea in his chapter on school years in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, where he had that personality number one, you know, born the son of a Lutheran pastor in northwest Switzerland. You know, goes to school, seen as a bit odd. People call him Father Abraham rather mockingly. Mm-hmm. And then there's this other thing, his number two personality, which is completely distinct from all of that, doesn't really exist in conventional space and time, and which he describes as having no definable character at all. Born, living, dead, everything in one, a total vision of life, but no specific character. Now, if one goes to the Book of the Law in the first chapter, verse 8, the cub, it says, the cubs is in the coo, not the coo in the cubs. Worship then the cubs that my light may be shed over you. What is a coo and what's a cubs? A cubs in Thelemic terminology is the inner star, the inner light in each of us. The coo is the vehicle that we have, all the multiple levels of vehicles. Again, you know, some traditions will say there's a mental body, an astral body, an emotional body, and a whole lot of concentric and relative, you know, progressively finer levels of beingness, to which for this morning I'm going to say, or this afternoon rather, yeah, whatever. The idea, though, as Crowley says in his commentary on the Book of the Law, the idea is to make these veils of the coup progressively more transparent. Now, in any mystery school, what you do to achieve this transparency is work through the Sephiroth, initially from Malkuth through to Netzach, and then the periphery of Tifereth, before actually making that breakthrough into a connection with the inner in Tifereth itself. You are all the time looking at different aspects of your own number one personality. your mental attitudes, your moralities, your concepts of what is what ought to be and what ought not to be. And psychological projection is a very critical thing in this. Learning to see all the stuff that annoys or upsets you or bothers you or excites you in the world around you is a way of discovering the things in yourself that you need to become familiar with so that you can back away from them or not be controlled by that kind of reactivity in order to get the adept self going. Asian systems, you know, using a very broad term, tend to be more simply introspective. I can't comment too much on that because I've always followed this Kabbalistic system. So I don't say whether they are good or bad. I simply say that I know the one system and not the other very well. The point is that while you are moving back from these veils, these obscuring concepts and thought forms and mental constructs, this so-called adept self begins to emerge of itself. You're not in control of the deal. You're not in command of its appearance and disappearance. You can learn to relate to it and call it more willingly and dismiss it more willingly as time goes by. That's part of the training of the system. But it really, you start finding this thing that, as Jung says, doesn't have specific personal characteristics. It's not about right and wrong, which much of our personality and much of our mental reality is made from. This is what I approve of. This is what I do not like. Right down to stupid nitty-gritty things about disapproving of people who prefer cappuccino to regular coffee, that sort of stuff. And this second personality is the foundation of adepthood. It is the adept self. Briefly, in my own understanding, and I think other people might want to look at it differently, but to me, what we call the Ruach, which runs all the way from Yesod up to Chesed. So you've got the lunar sphere of Yesod, the mercurial sphere of Hod, the Venusian sphere of Netzach, the solar sphere of Tifereth, the martial sphere of Gevurah, which is all about, you know, what is ought to be eliminated, what should be cut back and reduced and cut down. And on the other side, facing Gevurah, that martial sphere, you have the Jovian or Jupiterian sphere of Chesed, which is all about abundance and fullness and generosity. It's mercy as opposed to the severity of Gevurah. And I think a lot of what the adept self is about is the relationship between those two as mediated by or mediated through Tifereth in the center. So it's there, it's part of the mind, it's accessible to us, it's never that far away. It's always sending little hints, intuitions, murmurings in the mind, dreams, and some of the stuff we do when we start practicing magic. It is not the Holy Guardian Angel itself, but it is definitely broad and comprehensive enough to be able to receive stuff, communications from the very highest parts of the tree, really deep intuitions and messages directly from the angel. So this is the thing that you are trying to bring into focus, bring into your life, and that you're learning to heed and to follow its guidance as you develop your magical consciousness and your esoteric understanding. That's it's kind of the initial target before you're actually talking about things like knowledge and conversation. I hope that's reasonably clear to begin with.
It reminds me of the passage from Liber 65, where the colors are many, but the light is one. And it makes me think of like the, almost like you can think of the spheres of the tree of life as being almost like the different colors that are like filters, and the light itself coming through them is refracted in different ways through each of those different spheres, but the light itself being one.
Yeah, very much so. All aspects, I think, of the Ruach are in some way involved in this, along with the three Sephiroth at the top of the tree, Bina, Chokhmah, and Ketha, which collectively constitute the neshama, this supernal or intuitive consciousness, which the more you talk about it, the more you muddle things with words and adjectives and things that just are only partly applicable. So the adept self is a little bit closer to what we're all about in magical education. And moving yourself into it or identifying with that adept self is a key tool in developing real magical ability. If you're on that level of contact, if you're in line with this thing, you certainly find that invocations and magical work are much more effective. Not always, as Crowley says, there is often, you know, an unknown factor that just means stuff doesn't work out when you do an invocation or a magical ceremony. But most of the time, you will find that you are getting more deeply into stuff and you are perceiving and experiencing and feeling very different stuff the more this adept self comes to the center of things. Now, defining it more precisely is, I think, an error. When you try and throw too much definition on stuff, you inevitably not just restrict it, but bring it back down into the parts of the psyche that are closer to your everyday self. And that means it can't receive what we might call higher inspiration as effectively and as comprehensively. Because all of this work we're doing in magic and training ourselves magically is about stretching the mind to encompass so many more concepts, so many more ways of looking at the world and experiencing the world, and exposing ourselves to deep intuitions that when you write them down, we've discussed this before on these podcasts, you think, well, that looks stupid on the screen or on the page. Yet, in fact, when the idea came to you, it's really something pretty profound and deeply affecting. It moves you in certain ways. So the whole thing is an opening process, and the adept self is part of what teaches us to accept the adept self and then eventually move on to the greater scope of the Holy Guardian Angel itself. There are two or three things that I think you can say about the experience, basing, again, what I'm saying on my own experiences. This may not be everyone's, what everyone undergoes. But first of all, I find there's very little emotional quality in communications from the adept self. There's almost none of what psychologists call affect. It's just like, well, here it is. No, the universe is an arbitrary set of impulses that are somewhere guided by something far beyond human comprehension. And that idea will come to you as an immediate revelation in one word or one thought. Rather like somebody saying, it might rain later today. It just doesn't, at the time, have in it deep emotional power. Yet when it hits in the conscious self, there can be this, oh, wow, sense of suddenly feeling silenced. It's very non-judgmental. The fact that you might have made a huge mess of your life, an enormous chaos out of your own regular existence, is not that important to it, as long as you can get to the point where you realize, I'm making a mess, and the reason my life is a mess is because it's me who's making it that way. Either through poor choice of relationships and friends, refusing to follow little intuitions about needing a new home, a new job, a new relationship, whatever. The stuff just comes to us, it's there, and it's like this is an old analogy from 30 years ago, when a letter would drop through the letterbox. There it was. It might be a bill. Oh, my God. It might be a letter from an old friend who would say, I'm coming to visit the town in 2 months' time. Will you be available to get together? You never know what it would be, but it would just be that little sound of an envelope hitting a doormat or the floor. Nothing more than that. And yet there can be an enormous amount of content, perhaps something that you'll spend months or years working on subsequently. And it's willing to advise us all the time, the adept self. But you have to listen to the advice and try to incorporate the advice in your life. That's the tricky part. Okay, now I see what I need to do to make things much better, but that means changing 57 different small aspects of my current life. This could take some time, and my life is the way it is because I decided that looking at it in certain ways, behaving in certain ways, and living in a certain manner would be fulfilling and at least safe. Now I realize it's not particularly fulfilling, and I have to step outside of my safety zone. So that's where you suddenly find that the adept self has put you in a situation where you're going to need to stretch your understanding.
I like the reference to the fact that you just some little thing can kind of have a cause a breakthrough for you, that it brings to mind like the idea of water kind of gradually wearing away at maybe big, you know, glacial chunks of ice, and then if you just one little thing suddenly seems to take a whole wall of ice out, and it but it was all the everything leading up to that makes the actual experience so meaningful, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the whole system that we work with in Hermetic Kabbalah is very much alchemical in that way. Building up, building up, building up, transforming the fluid that we're working on to the point of saturation. Suddenly, you know, it's at maximum, and there is a flipping. A door opens, a window opens, you know, a lock suddenly is no longer locked. Mm-hmm. And there you are with a new understanding. Look back on it a while later and you'll realize you've made some accommodation with what was given to you in that moment or those minutes or that hour. And you will have begun to incorporate what you were told. You've probably also still got some work to do that might take years longer. I mean, I think every occultist finds this thing of being able to jump into certain stuff very quickly. And other things, especially personality traits, just won't dissolve easily. Now, you look at Crowley's career, and it's extraordinary that when you read the late work, he's not this cocksure young man telling everyone how they ought to live. He's far more cautious. One of my favorite quotes that I came across a while ago was that he wrote the commentaries on the Book of the Law, the first one a few years after he'd received the book. Then I forget when the second comment comes, but about 10 years after that. By the time he got to the late 1920s, 1930s, he realized he would never dare again try and pin down the meaning of this multifaceted text that he had, that he simply couldn't explain in, you know, basic propositions. He'd explained a lot of stuff in propositions, particular practices, the theory of magic, all of that. But actually explaining the whole of the Book of the Law was not possible. You would only mislead people by putting restrictions on the multifaceted aspect of each verse of that book. Some stuff is very straightforward. The cubs is in the coup, not the coup in the cubs, worship in the cubs. That's a straightforward verse, fairly easy to explain, like a lot of the stuff in the first chapter of the book. Then you come across all of this stuff at the third chapter, which seems to be about you got to go out like Frodo and, you know, beat everybody up and bring back the ring or destroy it or whatever. And there are levels of subtlety in that chapter that don't even look subtle until you've really spent a considerable amount of time trying to understand what those verses are telling you.
Mm-hmm. his experience in trying to approach creating a commentary on the Book of the Law, as you're describing it, it's almost like he couldn't come to that realization about its true multifaceted nature without first making those attempts, you know, having those bold attempts at trying to define it and quantify it and that sort of thing. But that's kind of an interesting, it goes into what you were talking about earlier about the way that the adept consciousness works with us and the way that the angel works with us. If we were told right now, as we are in so many ways, that we're fucking up and we're not doing things right, and this is why, if we could feel like, oh, if only I was just doing things the right way and didn't have to go through the whole process of struggling with it for so many years, why can't I just deal with this earlier? And it's like, well, yeah, when you've gone through it and everything like that, it's already done by that point. Yes.
The other thing is that, including Crowley's own work, there have been so many efforts to create a religion out of Thelema. Mm-hmm. And the only religion you can legitimately create is one that is absolutely personal to you as an individual. There's that line from the Confessions where, you know, all I ever wanted to do was show how another man could cut his way through the jungle, which, you know, it was Crowley's proper job. And people still, I think, so often take his career and think, I'll model myself exactly on that. Well, no, you can't. You're not Aleister Crowley. You're not living in the early 20th century. You're not living in Britain, probably. And if you are, it's a different Britain. You know, the British Empire just doesn't count for much anymore, whereas in his life, during his lifetime, it was still extremely significant. And that's a huge factor in all of his attitudes to other people, other countries, other cultures, and so on.
Yeah, it's almost like the Britain would have been, I suppose, to the world what the United States was to the world in the 1990s.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Britain was top dog, lost that position really after World War One, and was undeniably knocked down a few pegs after World War Two. There's a lot of historians who've made careers out of tracing every minute decision and trying to, you know, pin down where a certain degree of decline happened for Britain and then subsequently the United States. The thing is, though, you're going to have to find your own combination of methods and ideas. To give an example, I was in my 20s more interested in a kind of Gnostic Christianity. And I had a long struggle with, well, you know, I'm still sort of torn between what I'm supposed to be doing, which is, you know, putting Rahu Kuit up there in place of that conception. And of course, the adept self was constantly trying to say, well, what is the difference experientially? You know, never mind that, you know, one is a bird with a red circle around his head, and one is a man with a golden circle around his head. But there are aspects here that coincide, and there are always spiritual techniques which go back to the age of Isis and the age of Osiris that can be adapted. Line from the Book of the Law, the rituals of the old time are black, let the good ones be purged by the prophet, and, you know, the other ones deleted from your database. And that's how you have to do it after a certain point. There isn't a precise manual on exactly what to do. Once you have gone through that, what we call the first order process leading into Tiferet, at that point, something from this adept self should be really, really active inside you. Now, I'm talking here not so much about the AA experience. I think this comes more the end of 110 or beginning of 29 in AA. I'm looking more at this approach I've been through myself in Golden Dawn style temples, where you are working through the four initial Sephiroth, 10, 9, 8, and 7. on the yetzeratic level, trying to break through to clearer yetzeratic consciousness and creating something that can receive breatic consciousness, the creative world, the archangelic world, the level where mental turmoil and chaos and confusion stop, and there is simply perception happening. Maybe highly excited or ecstatic perception, but the key thing would be perception. So you're developing, in my own school, Temple of the Silver Star these days, and in any of these similar types of training, you're developing the beginnings of a receptive self, full active participation, full exercise of will is going to follow on from this as the adept self comes to the foreground and starts being given more scope to speak, to disturb your peace of mind, and generally make things interesting. I think we've just started on the topic, that the problem I'm going to have with this topic is I can only talk from a particular and personal experience. Everyone else is going to have to realize they've got to translate that into their own necessary experience and their own necessary explorations, which might be extremely different to my own ones. You might have worked a lot with a pagan tradition. You might have done far more with Buddhism or yoga, Sufism, you know, whatever. There's so much out there now. The supermarket is well stocked. And people come into Thelema from having done whatever made sense to them initially, because initially they're working with personality number one that tells them this is the stuff that life's about. Either you choose something that relates to what your regular life's about, or you choose the antithesis. You choose that opposite thing that will compensate, that will make regular life more meaningful in a way that regular life just isn't meaningful on its own. So you're always going to be finding, again, Crowley's jungle that you have to cut through. Anybody's advice, anybody's experience, Crowley's, the other great adepts, even my own, you know, especially my own, you know, are very individual approaches to this. But the more information you have on that, I think the more confidence you will have to step forward into your own unknown region.
Yeah, so I was also mentioning when we first started chatting today that I coincidentally happened to be making a post on the Toronto Thelema Instagram and Facebook. Check it out. it was a quote from Magic Without Tears, chapter 42. I remember that because it's number 42 is the answer to the life, the universe, and everything.
It's everything, yes, of course.
So, but it was, regarding the self, and I didn't know that this was what you were going to be talking about today, so it was kind of, it's funny how that tends to line up with our discussions and whatnot. So it's where Crowley is talking about the, it's not the subject of the guardian angel per se, it's a subject of the self. But he goes into the fact that he views the holy guardian angel as something other than the higher self. And he's emphasizing the importance of the distinction, because as he's saying with general invocations, if you don't go in with the attitude that there's a difference between you and Jupiter when you're invoking Jupiter, then you can very easily go down the rabbit hole that he warns against with mysticism, where it just ends up being ego inflation. So yes, keeping that idea of there's a duality between you and the thing or the entity that you're invoking, including the Holy Guardian Angel, not making that mistake of assuming that it's simply the higher self that you're dealing with there.
Yeah, that term higher self is always a muddling one in Thelema. The angel is not the higher self. That's always something strongly stressed. The adept self is a higher self in a sense, but I think using that term higher is itself misleading. Maybe more internal, you know, the internal self. I just prefer adept self because the word adept implies capability, insight, wisdom, and the ability to access power. I mean, again, one of the problems with mysticism is not just the ego inflation, but the fact that you can kind of get lost in the clouds and you end up like A.E. Waite, who Crowley slams him and treats him as a punchline. I think the man had an extraordinary ability, and he seems to have had a certain kind of strange charisma. I don't know if there is a biography of him other than his own one, but he's so evasive, he's so elusive, that the mystical side of him swamped a lot of what he was accomplishing or might have accomplished. Now, another aspect of this adept self, and I think it's a very critical one, is developing confidence. Usually when somebody comes into the mysteries, they're either very shy and nervous, or alternatively, it's like, look, I'm not going to let these people con me and brainwash me. I'm going to tell them I know X and I've had some experiences. And besides, I've seen at least a dozen YouTube videos on how to do a pentagram ritual. So, you know, I know what I need to know. Then eventually you begin to realize the whole subject is far deeper, more subtle, and more complex than you thought it was. And it's not just in its own box. It's going to touch every aspect of your own life. And there is a phase there where you are kind of trying to wriggle yourself into a suit of clothes that don't quite fit. And the clothes are trying to, you know, like the sort of astral spandex, they're trying to adapt to you. Eventually, you start to become able to handle the stuff. You learn how to do ritual properly. You learn how to time yourself in a group ritual. You learn how to do your pentagram ritual at a good, stately pace with that sense of power coming through. You're focused. You're right in the zone, you know, and you allow yourself to feel stuff that's happening around you and perceive it with kind of something outside of regular peripheral vision, but you're seeing stuff or sensing or perceiving stuff. Again, that's partly the adept self, not only showing it to you, but allowing you to see what is there in the ceremony and the ritual. Then you have to deal with the idea of developing confidence. Some people just roar right in. They're perfectly happy going into areas of darkness and strangeness, I suppose. They just jump in with both feet. And I thought I would do that. And I can remember realizing at a certain point that a lot about magic puzzled and scared me, not because I thought I was going to, you know, get possessed by demons. I mean, that's the conventional criticism, oh, you're dealing with the powers of darkness. You're dealing with darkness because everything that you undergo in life leads you into areas that you can't be certain about. You're just going to have to go out into the world that day and encounter what it throws at you. Magic is the same. You're going out in the night to see what life throws at you. It's not necessarily hostile. It's not going to damage you, but it is going to require you to stretch your understanding. And there is this thing, you know, Dion Fortune talks about it a bit. You're all alone. Yes, there's group work that the temples do because that puts us all in touch with a bigger level of consciousness, with a deeper source that we can tap into. There's a sense of protection that's real that comes from being part of a group. You're plugged into the whole, you know, source of the Western mysteries. So you might stumble and fall, but no, you're not psychologically or spiritually speaking going to break a leg. You will only twist an ankle. And that's just one of those lessons that you're going to need in order to carry on, carrying on. But there is that time when you realize you've gone into something that is beyond where you've been before, and that there's more stuff up ahead that you can't really visualize for yourself. And if you start putting too much imagery onto it, you draw things from your own past, you start pulling stuff out of the dynamics of your relationships with your parents and other authority figures, and that just muddies the waters rather than you being able to see fairly clearly what you're doing. Obviously, Enochian work tends to be particularly like this because you're going into strange landscapes, and everybody's mind tends to render those landscapes differently. So it's kind of hard to pin down what's there, because it's being the mind, the personal mind, is rendering it in something, in a form that is coherent, a form that is maybe less scary than it would be if you realized the mutability of things on that level.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's, you know, you've got Crowley's Vision and the Voice. David Shoemaker put out his Winds of Wisdom book a few years ago, where he scribed the whole system. Very different stuff. Yet you can see when you think about it, there is an underlying structure. There's a kind of conceptual skeleton in these aetheres that is the same thing. But the flesh that is built onto that is quite different depending on the individual. And it's coming in from a pretty deep level of the psyche.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not where you normally go to in your everyday life. And you need to develop that courage, that confidence to go there. The adept self is not only pulling you into that or pushing you into that, it's also, you know, being there with you and saying, this is the next step.
Mm-hmm.
But often, you know, we get scared as occultists by the things that go bump in the night because we weren't expecting the bump in the night. Even cool stuff can leave you a little bit shaky because it's outside of your comfort zone. It's outside what you've been through before. It's outside of the things you've seen or thought or heard or felt or experienced in some way. The adept self is there, pulling you in and being there with you. It is, of course, you on a deeper level. But for a long time, that kind of integration with the adept self is not very close. I think it comes more for people who are in the very advanced stages of adeptship, that they can pull it all together into one piece, into one particular understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a good way to think of maybe being able to approach things as well, because I feel like the fear or the lack of confidence, let's call it, often comes from, I mean, it obviously can come from visceral fear and reactions to things, but it can also simply come from kind of being in your head. Once you're self-conscious, you know? So, I mean, Crowley talks about energized enthusiasm, and I think that's a great cure when, you know, if you don't have a clear and conscious sense of the adept self at hand, maybe that's a good way to start from, is thinking in terms of generating energy. What the hell did I just call it? Energized enthusiasm.
Enthusiasm, yeah. As opposed to dispersed enthusiasm, which is easy to fall into. Yeah, energized enthusiasm focuses you, and it creates a channel, a vehicle, a pathway for the will to come through. Again, adept consciousness is not the will, but it's in touch with that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very extensive realm of business contacts, if you wanted to use that analogy. And it can pull through the will and therefore focus your magical act on the invocation in hand. That whole thing about, you know, true will, unassuaged of purpose, delivered from the lust of result, is every way perfect, is one of the trickiest things in magic.
Mm-hmm.
Being at that point where you are really, I'm into this, but you're not anticipating, you're not demanding that the whole experience be something. You're simply going into it and going through it and experiencing it with enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
When that happens, it's fun. And I spent years trying to stabilize that attitude in myself because it was rather foreign to all of the mental habits that I'd had in my former life. It wasn't easy. Just being able to stay with an invocation, being able to stay with an exercise, knowing that my mind would make me feel scared, bored, distracted, concerned about the bill I didn't pay yesterday when I had the opportunity and forgot, and all of that stuff. Energized enthusiasm puts you where you need to go and helps you get there.
Mm-hmm.
Will is, it's multi-level because you start off thinking it is volition. Eventually, you end up wrangling and wrestling with Gevura, which is about will on the individual level. It is not, however, the true will of the Sefira Chokhmah, which is the true will, the pure will, just sheer force coming out. That's pretty difficult stuff to mediate pure force. I forget who said it, but somebody whose opinion I trusted said that he'd never been able to do much in the way of a satisfactory invocation of Chokhmah. It's just, you can't get yourself to that level. I did one once and thought, well, he was obviously wrong. Never again, after several efforts, could I get anything more than rather lame cliches out of what I called on. I just could not operate at, excuse this cliche, that vibrational level.
Mm-hmm.
It might come through me, but it wasn't something that I could be in.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a bit beyond any capability that I have or expect to have to live at that level in this lifetime. I think it's okay to know that you're not going to get the entire way through the tree of life. That's one of those things that can compose the mind. And you can say, I will go so far and perhaps no further. But considering where I started from, it's not been a bad distance that I've covered. The adept self is what will get you there, and learning to trust it and learning to trust it again when you have not fully followed the guidance, when you've not allowed yourself to be aware of all the little things coming in peripherally from the adept self and therefore not achieving quite what you hoped for. It's an ongoing negotiation. You never get it finally settled, because as soon as the adept self recognizes that you've stabilized at a particular level of understanding, it's like, okay, let's go on to the next thing. Are you ready for more adventures? And you can't sort of retire. You can't sit back and rest on your laurels. There's always something else being reshaped, something else being declared, something else being eliminated. The adept self also takes away things that no longer have use, or that you've done so many times that you just don't need to do that anymore. And one, there was a time some years ago when I did a lot of invocations of Mercury. Several of the initial ones were really cool stuff. I was seeing internal landscapes I'd never seen before, stretching off into maybe not infinity, but halfway there. And finally, it was like, okay, you're getting a little too stuck on watching the same episode of the same TV series. Mm-hmm. Let's try a different TV series altogether, which I then had to accommodate. I had to adapt to that. I had to deal with a certain frustration that I had to leave that comfort zone. But the adept self was saying, you've got to go on with this, go further.
Yeah, bringing it back around to the idea of like the different spheres being the different colors and that sort of thing. I guess that's an element of balance. You have to explore those different facets of the self and the different facets of the not self, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, and the personality patterns don't disappear. One of the most depressing things about this is something you find, you think you really got a handle on 4 or 5 years ago, you know. It creeps back. It's still one of the things that is established in your psyche.
Oh, God, I've become my father.
I'm sorry, I completely lost it there because the other day I was looking in the mirror as I was shaving and thinking, God, I look like my dad. because I always remembered him as an older man. He was, you know, nearly 40 when I was born. So it was always an older person to me with graying hair. And suddenly I looked at this guy in the mirror with graying hair and thought, Lord, that's bad. You do become your father. And I mean, parent relationships is another issue altogether. Psychotherapists have made their fortunes over those. But there are times when you realize that certain aspects of being your parent are not bad things. There was a certain amount of practical wisdom in the way they did things, even if it's not profound truth and fully empowered dignity of the realized adept, yada, 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 yada. You need to use those tools because they are available to you, but not quite in the manner that mom or dad used when you were young. All things that the adept self will incorporate. It will use anything that's to hand. Daft things that a boss you couldn't stand used to say, which might, you know, because some people are maddening to be around, yet they still say things that are true. Parents, same thing. They can tell you stuff that, oh, yeah, you were right, but I had to go a long way away from that in order to establish a standpoint where I could appreciate what I was being told. The adept self will incorporate that stuff, those ideas, those, you know, cliches from your childhood, because they have some truth in them, which is how they became cliches in the first place. But they need to be understood from a rather different standpoint that your own parents would have been afraid to adopt. Isn't all this fun?
Well, I mean, it's like, I know for myself, I was going to say your religious background, but not everybody comes from a religious background per se. But for myself, having been raised Catholic, there might have been a time in my life where I felt like, okay, I've expunged that, so to speak, and have gotten past it. And it's like, no, it doesn't work that way. It's like, it's the eternal recurrence, it seems like, constantly going back and being with it.
Yeah, and there's some stuff, you know, some of the Catholic writers are astonishing. You know, Teilhard de Chardin, parts of Thomas Aquinas. I was reading some Aquinas one day and thinking I should know a bit about this guy, and it was like, wow.
Yeah, I'm reading this Augustine, guy, same kind of thing. Like, there's, you know.
This guy's deep. This guy knew stuff, but he'd realized stuff, and he's explaining the realization he'd come to, but obviously after years of wrestling with this difficulty. And at the same time, you look at institutional Catholicism and you just, you know, head in hands, and, no, please go away. You know, Father X, whoever you were, you know, I don't ever want the image of your smug face in my mind ever
The vision
again.
Of Christ that thou dost see is my vision's greatest enemy.
Yeah, well, Blake was obviously, you know, a deeply realized man, but who was utterly misunderstood and mocked in his own lifetime. And I forget when he came, was rescued, but he sort of languished on the sidelines of English literature and certainly of mysticism. I think he's only been really appreciated in the last half century. And that was a man from, you know, late 17 and into the early 1800s. All this stuff comes in. And unfortunately, I think Crowley was wrestling so much with Christianity himself, as he knew it, which was a very strict kind of Protestant Christianity, that he tended to throw the entirety of the thing in the garbage when he should have perhaps more selectively picked out things. He didn't like St. John of the Cross, and I think John is pretty terse in what he has to say. He's very concise, and he really went through his own ordeals to get where he got to in The Dark Night of the Soul.
Mm-hmm.
Crowley did not like The Dark Night of the Soul. He liked Miguel de Molinos. I'd go the other way. And Molinos struck me as, this guy goes on and on and on. St. John of the Cross is much more concise. And there are other little gems in there in the Christian traditions among the mystics and the people who were kind of allowed to stay, you know, as Catholic reference points, but looked on as suspect. Those people are always fascinating because they were individuating. They were going into an area that was presented to them that they couldn't set aside. They couldn't resist it. They needed to include some Greek philosophy or something they got from a Jewish commentator on the Bible or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or just some revelation that struck them in a visionary way that they couldn't set aside. You take these bits and pieces and you end up with a hodgepodge, or ostensibly a hodgepodge. Behind it, you will find that there is a kind of structured path, a structured belief system that you can't be too analytical about, but it's certainly very real to you and can nourish the soul's need to feel that life has meaning and that there is a shape to your own existence.
Yeah, it seems like it's just the same old story of we're all kind of looking at the same reality, and the points of contention tend to come from the way that you try to interpret your experiences of that reality, or your the way that you try to make sense out of it, particularly when you stop experiencing it and trying to turn it into, you know, something clear. When you stop experiencing it and learning from that and just start using pure logic to try and suss out what everything means, then there's a tendency to say, well, this is how I structure things. How can I make this fit into that? And it's you end up like forcing square pegs into round holes a lot of the time and that sort of thing, trying to force your orthodox point of view or whatnot.
And you do end up having to find a different shaped peg and a different shaped cavity to insert it into before the thing finally begins to come together.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where true will starts to become real, and you realize that things that seem incompatible actually are complementary to each other. They operate maybe on different levels or different sides of your life, but they are necessary to the totality of yourself. And I think we all have this thing. This is particularly in modern Western society, we are very much oriented towards success. In some form, we need to be successful. People are always trying to make us successful or happy. The paradoxes of existence don't actually permit that. And I had an experience in the last 10 days. I look after two or three dogs here. One of them has been very ill for almost a year. And finally, she died. And that was it. I knew she was very close to her end. I dug a grave in the garden and I put her into it, covered it over, and, you know, told a close friend of mine. And my friend started trying to cheer me up. And it was like, well, no, I mean, I'm not going to go into some dreadful, grief-stricken period of deep depression for 6 weeks. I've been expecting this since the beginning of this year. I'm not surprised it's finally happened. And as this poor dog's legs got weaker and weaker in the past 2 weeks, you know, I knew we were coming right to the finish. But it was appropriate to feel sad, and I got frustrated with this person who was trying to make me feel better. It's going to be okay. You know, you have to be philosophical about all this stuff. And I don't have to be philosophical about anything. I felt sad. I loved this dog. You know, we were always close. She was very devoted to me. I kind of singled her out when she was a lot younger, made a pet of her when she was part of a group of dogs And she just always looked at me with this, you know, devoted stare. It was freaky at first till I realized it wasn't hostile. It was like, you know, that was the dog looking to me for contact, reassurance, affection. So she'd gone. I'm going to feel sad. And feeling sad is appropriate. Now, feeling sad has nothing to do with being happy and successful in the modern North American or Western way of looking at life. You're not supposed to do that. But yeah, I did for several days. I was very sad, not, you know, hopeless, not incapable of functioning, at least after the first day. I just got on with the various tasks I had to perform. But right immediately, I was knocked flat. I knew this was coming. I'd watched her getting ill, thought, okay, this is it. Finally, she died, you know, literally just went dead while she was in my arms. That doesn't fit. My reaction doesn't fit the normal perspective on things. And we were very much trapped in this idea of being successful, meeting that expectation of other people. Going back again to that quote from Jung, where he talks of the first and second personalities. His first personality was being a kid in the late 1800s in rural Switzerland, and he was expected to be certain ways. He was expected to react in certain ways. There's always this societal demand. People think they're doing you a favor by trying to drag you back into the consensus, back into the accepted field of attitudes and ideas. Thelema, on the other hand, is going to put you in different places where you will feel ecstatic joy. You will feel a sense of awe and wonder at times when you've done something that has brought you to a vision or an understanding, a deeper perception that magic can give you. And of course, you can't talk about it to anyone without sounding either daft or crazy or just silly. Maybe your own teacher would understand a bit better, but really it's absolutely individual to you. But the adept self is always pulling you away from consensual society. It's always trying to make you see things in a different light, to see that wherever you are with the present set of values, with the present set of anxieties, with the present set of fears of war, famine, environmental disaster, you know, falling asteroids, whatever it is, you have chosen a path because you were led to that path by the rudimentary adept self, and you're on that path. And dealing with that and becoming reconciled to it, I think, is a lifetime job. And it can't always be done. There will be times, there will be days when you just think, what did I get into this for? Why didn't I just, you know, go and sell real estate? I could have sold real estate. I could have made millions. Look at the market right now. I wouldn't have to worry about all of this stuff. I wouldn't have to be continuing to try and make sense of what really happens after death. What really is the reality of this astral world I've explored? What, you know, is there really a, you know, deep third order of masters, or is this just some kind of idealistic projection? No, and you can get onto that one forever. Rather than saying, you know, life will work if I use this perspective that the tree gives me, this idea that there are consciousnesses that are guiding and guarding and drawing us onward. It's a useful approach to take, even if it's not objectively true. The famous line from Magic in Theory and Practice, you know, in this book, you will encounter gods and Sephiroth spirits and something else. The student is most earnestly warned against giving objective reality to any of these things. However, so the subjective reality is immensely important for a meaningful life. And that is what the adept consciousness is aiming to draw us towards and aiming to help us embrace and experience and internalize and confer, not necessarily peace and happiness, but an appreciation that peace is there, that not everything in the universe is this destructive struggle between utterly conflicted forces that can never be reconciled or never be transcended.
It's bringing to mind, and I had to dig it up, the bit from chapter 2 of Liber 65 with the, I guess I could call it the parable of the swan, where riding on the swan with the crazy little child.
Boy.
Yeah.
Yes. Whither goest thou? No whither, no whence. Yes.
Then with no goal, why this eternal journey? And I laid my head against the head of the swan and laughed, saying, is there not joy ineffable in this aimless winging? Is there not weariness and impatience for who would attain to some goal?
Yes.
It seems absolutely pertinent to this what discussion at hand, for sure.
It sure does.
Well, thanks so much for talking with me again, Edward. This is a really interesting subject matter to delve into.
Hey, my pleasure. I enjoyed the discussion.
I appreciate it. So we'll talk again soon. 93.
93, indeed.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at torontofilema.org. Watch for events on Meetup and the usual social media spots, and join us again in the Darkly Splendid Abodes.